John F. Kennedy once stated at Rice University, quote, "We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard." Hey y'all, what's going on? It's Texas Chicks here, and we are excited to be back. How are you doing, Barb? How was your Mother's Day?
I'm doing good. Mother's Day was good. We went painting, went to the park, we saw the new Doctor Strange movie, and went to church, went out to eat with my mother and my brother. It was really good. How was your weekend?
It was good. I can't complain. Celebrated my sister's birthday and hung out with my mom today and got a lot of stuff done. And Jonathan and I went to go look at houses to move into potentially. But yeah, it's been pretty good. Super busy as always. But yeah, real quick before we start. Oh wait, back up. Happy late Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, by the way. For mothers and everything. But anyways, real quick before we start, you guys know that we have to talk business. Please make sure that you go on the Facebook page and vote for who you would like to hear about for this month's voters episode. Also, Barb and I are working on some cool new ideas, so please keep an eye out on social media for that. We plan to have something new for you all by the end of this month. Well, that pretty much wraps up all the business. Before we start, I got my information from Wikipedia.org, HeritageSociety.org, and ScholarWorks.sf. FASU.edu, and that one was written by Andrew Marr, which was like a college essay paper or something like that. But yeah, today, if you couldn't kind of tell by the quote, maybe a little bit, we will be covering the case of William Marsh Rice. One of my coworkers recommended this case to me, and I actually have never heard of this until this year. So I'm going to share it today and tell you how the founder of Rice University was actually murdered. Have you heard of this case?
I have not. No, I haven't. It literally ceases to amaze me how many cases we have yet to hear of.
I know, but this is like Rice University is such a huge school that it's insane that I have not heard of this in all of the years that I have been alive. But okay, so let's start with talking about William first. So on March 14th, 1816, here we are again in the 1800s, David and Patty Rice would welcome their new baby boy home. This little boy's name was William Marsh Rice. William was born in Massachusetts, but later would relocate to Texas around 1838. He would buy a few hundred acres in Houston and would start his legacy there. William started off by opening a store, almost, it was kind of like a gas station, but it was like referred to as a general store, so maybe like an 1800 versions of Walmart or something like that. But the store would change names a few times, but eventually it would end up as, basically it's W.M. M. Rice & Co., which is William Marsh Rice & Company. He would also start investing in the cotton industry and wanted to be in the transportation like section of the cotton industry, because you know you have like the production and all that stuff. He wanted to be in the transportation part of it. The store and the cotton industry situation would actually kind of work with one another. Basically, people would bring cotton to him and kind of drop it off to him, and in return they could shop at his store and get products that they need. That's kind of what I understood from the article that I read, which is kind of genius, because I'll talk about it a little bit later, but let's continue real quick. So this would actually start booming. He would eventually extend it as far as Mexico. This was not the only thing, and this is kind of where I was just talking about like a minute ago. Apparently, banks used to be illegal in Houston. So they were non-existent. Isn't that super weird?
Yeah, because that's like how the government and the states make a crap ton of money.
Yes.
As of now. So that's a little odd that it would be illegal, but I mean, back then as well, there wasn't a lot of money like how there is today, so maybe they felt like there wasn't a need for one.
Mm-hmm. And there probably was like a whole thing that happened why they were illegal, but I really did not know this, so don't judge me, guys, because you learn something new every day, apparently. But what he would do would provide those who needed banking services as the exchange for the cotton as well. The only thing that he wouldn't do is give out currency, which I'm assuming that means they would just use checks instead of like dollar bills, maybe. I don't know. It's a little weird, but like I said before, things started booming and William would make millions off of this. Around this time, I believe he was worth over $1 million, which is a lot of freaking money in the 1800s. Rice was a very smart businessman, and at the time, the only way that they could get goods to and from, like, every place really quick was by a boat or by horse and buggy, which obviously is not the quickest thing. William wanted to change this, so he started campaigning to have a way to transport goods on land with a path that was to and from, like, instead of just by roads or water. He would end up working with Houston Plank Road Company and would end up helping get a railroad track installed from Houston's northwest side down the Brazos River all the way to Dallas. This was a huge deal at the time and was changing the transportation of goods for the better. So basically, he was like a huge advocate for putting the railroad track in that we have now in Houston. Isn't that crazy to think about? Like, this one person had so many hands on different things in the community of Houston. It's just crazy. It was really interesting looking into this case and finding out about all the things that this man did, you know? But he wouldn't stop here and would continue to change transportation goods forever. But this isn't where his story actually ends. By 1865, Rice would be considered a millionaire, and by 1887, he would sit down with the president of the Houston School Board to talk about opening a high school. He would actually decide not to do the high school after they had their long talk or whatever, and would actually work towards opening an institute. Then, according to the heritagesociety.org website, which I took this quote directly from their website because I felt like if I named or if I reworded it any type of way, it would have taken away from the importance of this statement. So from their website, it said, on May 13, 1891, the trustees under a deed of indenture agreed to hold Rice's note for $200,000 as an endowment to provide for the establishment and maintenance of a thorough polytechnic school for males and females, designed to give instructions on the application of sciences and arts to the useful occupations of life, and that the library, reading room, scientific departments, and polytechnic school and the instruction, benefits, and enjoyment to be driven or derived from the institute to be free, end quote. Which is a lot of like very like smart words. So basically he put a down payment on building this university of $200,000, and the city took it and they would build the school up with science departments, art departments, and basically making it like a STEM school slash an art school all at the same time. And they would, it would have all these different rooms to help provide the help that was needed to teach. The one thing that I thought was super interesting was that it was for males and females. So it was interesting to see that females were included in this school, which I think would made it a difference, because we know that in back in the day, women were known to be at home and that's all they did was take care of the family and take care of the home while the husbands went out and, you know, provided money and all that situation. But it's interesting that it females were included in this, and I thought that was super cool. But yeah, does that kind of make sense now that I kind of
like, yes,
I guess summed it up? But I thought it was important to get exactly what this institute was going to be about. Anyways, after that, he now has his school, but things wouldn't be going so well for William forever. So like I said before, his industry was booming. He was helping with transportation in Houston. He did a lot of other things, but I didn't think that it was necessarily to go into all of them, but he would work. He was very much an advocate on how to make things, like how to bring in the new things to make life easier for everyone. But yeah, so just a few years later, I'm guessing that William's wife was sick. This was his second wife. And he and her family knew that she was going to be passing soon, because this whole will situation came in, and like, we'll kind of talk about it, but it didn't say 100%, but I'm assuming that she was on the verge of passing away. And that's when all of this stuff happened. But in 1896, Orrin T. Holt would change her will to basically say that she was a resident of Texas, and that would mean that she was able to get rid of half of William's assets that she had through their marriage. So basically, if you were not a resident of Texas, you were not allowed to have any of the assets through your marriage. And so I don't know who this Orrin was to her, but I'm assuming maybe like a brother or something. He basically stated that she was a resident, and he wanted to be able to get some of William's assets because they knew he was a wealthy man. They understood that. And so basically he kind of like changed her will and made it to where the family would get lots of things whenever she would pass away. With that being said, Orrin and other family members would actually get a lot of things from the death of his second wife. And this whole thing was done behind William's back. And he actually didn't find out until March 1897, which is basically like a whole year later. Once he found out, William would file a lawsuit against Orrin that would claim that he was not an actual resident, and that would mean he could not collect any assets. So the trial kind of starts, and Orrin would hire a lawyer named Albert Patrick. Well, Mr. Albert would, I don't know how this started and what the whole situation was and how this benefited anyone, but basically, Albert would see that William was very wealthy as well, and he would take a will and fake it under William's name and would name himself as the heir of Williams Institute, which is Rice University. And he would go through this whole process and finalize the paperwork and like get, you know, you have to, I can't remember what it's called, but you basically have to have somebody sign off as a second person saying that this is correct. And he would go through the whole process, finalize the paperwork. After the paperwork was complete, there was only one thing left. William had to be dead in order for the paperwork to be worth anything. This is when Patrick decided that William needed to die. William was going to have to be killed in order for him to get anything in return. So Patrick would find someone close to William to do the job. This man's name was Charlie Jones. So are you kind of like caught up, like all this will situation? First the wife dies, and this starts a lawsuit that brings in this Patrick guy, and Patrick would say, okay, this guy's very wealthy, and let me fake another will under his name, and we'll go from there. So
yeah, that literally blows my mind. How are you gonna be hired on as a lawyer and then say, oh my god, this guy has so much money, I'm going to come up with a will and I'm gonna name myself as a beneficiary, and they're not even related, and he may not have even known this, you know, known William before ever meeting him as a lawyer.
Yeah, so that's crazy. The crazy thing is like Albert was actually a well-known lawyer at the time in New York. Like he was this big lawyer, everybody knew of him, and he wasn't actually William's lawyer. He was the guy that William was suing's lawyer.
That's
so, isn't that freaking crazy that he was able to fake a will of someone who's not even his, like,
family?
Yeah, period. Like, I don't understand. It was 1800s was crazy, girl. But the first thing the two tried was, so now we're back to Charlie and Patrick are planning to kill William. So the first thing that they tried was giving William mercury pills, but nothing would come of it, and the first attempt was failed. Then the Galveston hurricane of September 8th, 1900, which I'm really want to cover that for you guys, because that is a crazy hurricane that happened. And we learned this in school and stuff like that, but it would pass through Houston and Galveston and would destroy lots, almost all of William's property. I think, like, when he bought the property, he bought, like, 300 and something acres of land, which was kind of how Houston was started. Anyways, it would destroy his property. Then, just a few days later, on the 16th of September, his cottonseed mill would burn down, which was another way that he was actually making money. So, William was just getting hit, like, left and right with bad things. Like, he would just could not catch a freaking break. But he was ready to take on the issue and wanted to use all of his money to repair all of the damages, which was $250,000 in 1900s money. So just kind of, you know, a lot of money in today's, right? So So he wanted to use all the rest of his money to repair damages, but this was a red flag to Patrick and Charlie because they wanted his assets. They would do anything to have it. So September 23rd, 1900, William Marsh Rice would pass away. The doctor who was doing the autopsy would say that William died of natural causes, but we know that is so not true in this case. Now we know. But the next day, a check would be forged by Charlie, but the problem was he spelled Albert's name like A-B-E-R-T or something like that. And so his name was spelled incorrectly in the recipient section. And this check was actually taking out all the money that was in William's account. So they're basically trying to cash out on his money, even though William had just died. So this was like a red flag. First, the name was spelled wrong, and this got this really large check, and the bank would end up calling and get verification on their suspicions that William had actually died the day before the check would be signed and turned in. Knowing this, the bank telegraphed, which is really crazy to have to be saying, but the bank telegraphed William's lawyer, and he would actually call the police and tell them what was happening. The police would find Charlie Jones, and he would confess to them that Patrick had told him to take chloroform and suffocate William to death. And that's kind of, I guess that's where the autopsy, what are they called? The guy, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but that's where he kind of said it was natural causes, because in 1900, I don't think chloroform was really easy to tell as a way of death, you know, as it is now. But yeah, so basically Charlie would walk in, suffocate William to death by the orders of Patrick. So this is when Patrick was arrested after Charlie had kind of said everything that happened, and he was actually sentenced to death. But just a few years later, he would be pardoned by the governor and released from prison in 1906. Just kind of like think about that. He forged a check. He also forged a will. And he also told a man to kill someone. He didn't do it, but he was basically the mastermind behind the situation. But he was let go after being sentenced to death.
Yeah, that makes me wonder if there was money or something like that being involved.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Money is just as powerful then as it is now. That's all. But he would actually die at the age of 74. So let's talk about Mr. Charlie. So Charlie was given freedom, because I'm assuming they do the whole, if you confess and tell us what happened, we'll make a deal with you or whatever. So he was given freedom after killing a man by suffocating him, but later in life would actually complete suicide at the age of 79. And I just kind of want to mention here that Charlie was not just anyone. He was actually William's valet, someone that he was supposed to trust. So to us, to me, valet means his driver, but I've heard from people that it was like his butler, and valet could mean something different to us, because I mean, we poor people out here, I don't understand how rich people live, but so yeah, but he was either his driver or his butler, it doesn't matter. He was working under him, and he was supposed to be that person that he could trust, because he was giving him the job to work for him, right? So yeah, he was killed by his own valet, and they're both, neither of the people who killed him were ever in prison for more than, I think, what, 6 years? But yeah.
I mean, I definitely feel like that ate at Charlie, because 79 is very old to commit suicide, and when you do commit suicide, you're doing it for a certain reason, and maybe the thought of, maybe he did care about William, but the thought of, like, having money kind of took over that, and he was not really seeing the truth behind it, that he really cared about William, and maybe, like, after all those years, it just kept eating at him, and he couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I just think it's crazy that really there's no justice in this whole situation. I mean, William went out of his way and changed Houston forever, basically, and these two men just get to walk on the streets or whatever. Anyways, what can you do now? They're both dead where they belong. But William's ashes would be cremated and kept in a vault at the school, which is kind of really creepy, and I would be super interested to see that. But later on, about 1930, they would actually spread his ashes under the monument that's seated on the school grounds, like, to this day. I think it's like a big statue of him sitting down in a chair or something like that. But his ashes were spread underneath that. But yeah, that basically wraps up today's case. What did you think, Barb?
I enjoyed it. I feel like you learn something new every day. And for something like doing what he did, literally leaving a huge legacy behind for Houston and having a gateway for people, young adults, middle-aged adults, to go to school and obtain degrees to better their lives, you know, become doctors, scientists, lawyers. That is a tremendous, like, great legacy to leave behind, honestly. Mm-hmm. And probably something that half the people around the world dream of leaving when they pass away. So I feel like this was really interesting, and thank you for covering it. I learned something new.
Yes, of course. I did too. I was going all in, like, deep dive in this, but I was like, I know I can't tell all this because this would be forever long, because he did so many other things. But if you're interested, feel free, like we always say, look in the notes and click on those links that we put in there and kind of read over them yourself. But please feel free to reach out to Barb or myself at tcwtm2021@gmail.com, or message us on Instagram at Texas Chicks Who Talk Murder with No Spaces, on Twitter at Texas Chicks Who with the number one, on Facebook at Texas Chicks Who Talk Murder. We are also asking that you guys take a minute of your time to give us a review on whichever platform you are using. This will help us reach a larger audience, and it also will help us kind of get into the, you know, higher ranks. But yeah, also, please share these stories to your friends and family, because if I would have never been told this, I probably would have never learned about any of that happened in this story. But last but not least, stay out of dark places and watch your back, because you never know who's lurking. Bye.
Bye.